Yep, to the question.
Okay.
Where are we?
We're on that Beis Omer Aleph, Masechta Sanhedrin. And I'm pretty sure that's where it's going to land. And we're going through the Mishnah. We're plowing through the Mishnah. At the beginning, it's a gigantic Mishnah. Actually, in the original Mishnah, it's divided up into smaller pieces, but we have it here. The last thing we discussed was something called Iber HaChodesh, Iber HaShana. Let's just recap. We're talking about adding another day to the month, and that's because some months in the lunar calendar have 29 days, some have 30 days, and we're going to have Beis Din in charge of deciding whether to make the month pregnant, so to speak, figuratively, meaning adding a day, making it into a mole, which means that there'll be 30 days to the month. The 31st day will be the first day of the next month. Or they'll decide to make it into a chaser, which means only a 29-day month. And then the 30th day will be the first day of the next month. And this will be a decision made by Beis Din. And for this, the Mishnah says, all we need, thank you very much, is a Beis Din of three judges. The story gets a little bit more complex when it comes to Iber HaShana. Iber HaShana, which means that because of the discrepancy of 11 days on every annually between the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. Now obviously the agricultural seasons are totally dependent upon the sun, not upon the moon. The moon has no influence on growth, on tvua, on peros, on produce. So what's going to happen is, as a result of an annual discrepancy between the lunar and solar calendars of 11 days, the seasons are going to start shifting around. Now the Torah requires that Pesach be Bechag Ha'aviv in the springtime, and Sukkot be at the time of Asifa, the time when they begin to gather together the fruits from the fields or complete the process of harvesting. And that's also a specific season in the agricultural calendar, which is going to be in the, you know, in the beginning of the fall, or shall we say the end of the summer months. And because of the shift and this discrepancy between the solar and lunar calendars, we're going to end up, if we don't do something urgently, with a situation in which Pesach is not in Chodesh Ha'aviv and Sukkot is not going to be the Chag Ha'asif. So in order to avoid such a situation, we do what's called the Iber HaShana. Now Iber HaShana really requires the supervision of the Sanhedrin, which is the High Court of Israel, made up of 71 judges. But the Sanhedrin will appoint a panel of judges to represent them. And that panel of judges is made up of three judges. But here we have the Shita, that's why it becomes more complicated, of Rav Shimon Gamliel. He says that although initially we begin the process with three judges, but then when we move towards a final decision, we have to add judges. So we'll add another two judges as part of the deliberation, and finally another two judges, till we finally end up with seven judges. And seven judges will finally decide whether to be Ma'aber Es HaShana. If, however, b'di'evid, the three original judges that were appointed and got permission from the Sanhedrin, they decided to be Ma'aber the Shana, and they went ahead and did so, although they shouldn't have done so, l'chatchila b'di'evid, even according to Rav Shimon Gamliel, we validate that Iber HaShana. Then we discuss the case of Smicha. Now, Smicha divides up into two different worlds that almost have no relationship one to the other. One is Smicha on the head of a karvan, and the other is Smicha Zekenim, in which we ordain a judge to be part of the tradition and the transmission of Torah, each mipi each, from Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Mishnah says that Smicha Zekenim requires three judges, according to Rav Shimon. Now what Smicha Zekenim is it? So Rashi and many of the Rishonim say we're talking about a karban. Which karban? This is a specific karban which is called Parhelim Dover Shel Tzibur. if you would have been with me in Masechet Zvachim, we spoke about this carbon in great length, in great detail. And this is a case where the Sanhedrin made a big mistake in their horah, in their decision, and it was a mistake which A, involved the violation of a chiyuv kares, so it's a very serious isur, and number two, the tzibur, the community of Israel, followed their ruling and implemented it. So we're talking about a situation where most of Klal Yisrael had violated an isur kares based on a mistaken ruling of the Sanhedrin. So in such a case, we take a carbon, it's a par, it's a cow, it's called par helim dovashol. Tzibur helim dov means in the absence of the knowledge of the law. And before we shech the cow, what we do is this kanim come down and they do smicha and they lean on the head of the par in the Beis HaMikdash. They recite a vidui, and that has to be done by no less than three zakenim. The Gemara later on is going to suggest another pshat in the Mishnah smichus kenim. That pshat is reflected here in the Rambam and his Pirush HaMishnayos, that we're talking about appointing judges. And when we appointed judges, we want them to be on the highest level. The highest level of ordination is called smuchim. And for smicha, we need three dayanim to confer ordination on a dayan and elevate his status to that of a samuch. And once you're a samuch, you can sit on a bezdin for virtually anything. If you're not a samuch, then you're on a lower level of ordination. Now we have another case called Egla Arufa. And again, just to reiterate what we said yesterday, we find a dead body that was slain, and it's between two cities, and we need a bezdin. And according to Rav Shimon, it's a bezdin of three judges. They'll go down to the shetach, you know, they'll start measuring to try to decide through this medida which city is the closest city in closest proximity to the slain body, and that city will be obligated in the mitzvah of Egla Arufa. Now, in both these cases of Smicha Zakenim and Egla Arufa, Rabbi Yehuda says we need five Zakenim. It's not enough to have three, we need five. And the Gemara is going to discuss why we have to jack it up from three to five. Then we discuss Chalitza and Miyun. These are two ways in which we can permit a woman to get married. In case number one, her husband died childless. Again, she may have children from another marriage. That's irrelevant. What's relevant is that he has no children. In such a case, when he dies, if he leaves a brother, then his wife needs chalitza. She can't get married to anyone without chalitza. And the chalitza has to take place in the presence of three judges. Then we have another case of being mater and isha to allow her to get married, and that's called miun. And that's a case of kiddushei derabbanan, where a ketana who's less than 12 years old, her father died, she is a yesoma, she is an orphan from her father, her mother decides to marry her off, or one of her brothers decides to marry her off, and that's called kiddushei miun. What does miyun mean? Miyun means that she can reject this marriage at any time until after she becomes 12, and then she continues the marriage. But if before that age comes about, she rejects her husband and she wants to get married to someone else, then that annunciation, that pronouncement of hers will take place in the presence of three judges. Hence, she's allowed to marry anyone else. And this leads us to where we were up to yesterday, a discussion about pidyon, or more precisely, ha'aracha. On the top right over there, you see in green, ha'aracha. Ha'aracha means to evaluate something in terms of its market value. Now, the Mishnah is going to talk about pidyon in a number of cases. So if you're looking in your Gemara, we're on the wide lines in a classic Gemara. I can't help you if you have a Steinsaltz, because I don't know how that's broken up. But in your classic Shas Bavli, we're in the third of the wide lines, and the second word in that line. Do you see what it says? Neta Ravai. Now, Neta Ravai and Maisa Sheni are kind of like two sides of a coin, meaning they have identical mirror image laws. They both have sanctity, and they both therefore require one of two possibilities. Either that you take these fruits and you bring them to Yerushalayim. You know, next week I think we have Yom Yerushalayim. So this Mishnah is for Yom Yerushalayim. What's the sanctity of Yerushalayim? That we take these fruits of Neter Avai. That means the produce of a tree in the fourth year. Or Maisa Sheni means one-tenth of your crop in the first, second, fourth, and fifth years of the Shemitah cycle. We bring these fruits up to Yerushalayim. That's one alternative. The other alternative is what's called pigeon, to redeem them on coins. And then we bring the coins up to Yerushalayim. Now, in order to redeem these fruits, we have to know exactly how much they're worth. That requires harocha to evaluate what they're worth. Now, why is it so complicated to evaluate fruits such that we need a bezdin for that? And the answer is because our Mishnah is talking not about fresh fruits immediately after they were harvested, but rather about peros shehirkivu. Hirkivu, I'll just write that word because if you're ever taking an Ulpan course, you'll want to know what this word means. Right? Hirkivu. Hirkivu, the noun, this is a verb, a conjugation of the word rikavon. Right? Rikavon means a spoilage. So when the fruits are no longer fresh, they begin to spoil. They're still edible and marketable, but clearly the value has gone down. I don't know if you've ever had experience where you buy something that the fruit man is trying to just pawn it off. He wants to get rid of it. It's no longer fresh, so he'll charge you half the price. So here we need the three people. Now, to evaluate this, I'm going to ask you a question that might sound like I'm tripping you up, and I am, and that is, what do these three people comprise? What do they make up, this entity of three people? A
Bezdin.
Okay, I tripped you up. It's not a Bezdin. These three people, I would call them a tribunal or a panel. They are not scholars. They are experts in the market value of something, of evaluation. They're what we call Bekiyim Beharochas Peros. They know exactly, they're experienced farmers or market people. And it's very interesting that our Mishnah now, when it requires three, divides up into two categories. Up until this point in the Mishnah, we've discussing three dayanim, three judges that make up a bezdin. But now we're not talking about judges at all, we're talking about a tribunal. By the way, all of you should know the answer to this question. When do we use a tribunal that's not a bezdin?
We do it for Yom Kippur.
Excellent. That's called Hataras
Nedarim.
Hataras Nedarim. When you gather three people together in order to be Matir and Neder, that's a tribunal. I'm not sure why the Mishnah here omits Hataras Nedarim. So you might say, because the Mishnah is only interested in Dayanim, the laws of judges. We don't require judges to be Matir and Neder. It's just a tribunal of three people. But then I would ask you, but what about Neter Avaya Maisa Sheni? That's a tribunal. So why does the Mishnah choose to emphasize this tribunal that is made up of experts who know how to evaluate these payrolls once they've begun to spoil? And it doesn't mention the three intelligent people who make up a tribunal for Hataras Nedarim. So that I don't know. We'll have to see a sugya later on and daf Yudalid. So, don't hold your breath, because until we get to Yudalid, it might be El time already. Okay. Then we have the case of Hekdesha. So until now we're talking about Neter Avai, my Sushen She'ein Dom of Yiduim. It's very difficult to shots up to evaluate its market value because it's already beginning to spoil. And now we have the case of Hekdesh. A person dedicates something for Hekdesh. That's called Berek HaBayis. That's called Kedushas Domin. Its value is sanctified and designated for the Migdash. Now he wants to be poda it and transfer the Kedusha onto Domin, onto its equivalent value in currency. He needs three. And once again, these are three individuals who are experts in evaluating something. In fact, here's a Pella that Gemara is going to establish that amongst these three is the person himself. He's the one who is Magdish it. Now, clearly in Dayanus, you know, you have to get together a Bezdin. You can't be part of the Bezdin. And even if you'd be a greatest scholar in the world, you can't be part of the Bezdin to judge yourself. But here, it's just a matter of evaluating, of Harocha. So all we need here is Bekius. Bekius means expertise. If you're an expert, you can be part of the tribunal, even though it's your own Hegdish that you want to be Poder. And now we get to Arachim. There's a whole Masechta in Shas called Masechta Arachim. Arachim means when somebody says, when he makes a declaration that he wants to give to Hegdesh the Erech of something, the value of something. He can even make a declaration called Erchi Olai. I want to give my own value to Hegdesh. And there's an entire chapter which we'll read in Yitzhak Shem this Shabbos about Erechin, and that's Vayikra Perek Chav Zayin. And there the Torah says that if a person declares Erechi Olai, we begin to evaluate based on his age and other factors how much he is worth to be sold on the market. And this is very interesting that the Mishnah says HaRochin HaMetaltalin. Metaltalin means that we're talking about something that's movable. And in this context, the Bar Tanura, who's one of the super commentators on the Mishnah, says that we're talking about Erchi Olai, a person who's offering his own personal value for Hegdesh. Then the Bar Tanura asks himself the following question: well, why is that metaltalin? The Mishnah calls it metaltalin, movables. Would you classify a human being as a movable object? And not only that, he asks even further, why do I need experts to evaluate a person? It all depends upon objective factors, his age, his health, and so forth and so on. So he says that this is a case where after he declared Erchi Olai, my value is to Hegdesh, then he didn't have any cash, any currency, like liquid assets, and he wants to pay up by offering metaltalin. And that comes under another principle, which is called shava kesef ki kesef, that you don't always have to pay your debts with currency, you could also pay with shava kesef, something that has value. Now, we're getting back to movable objects. Once we get to movable objects, then we need harocha, which in Aramaic is called shuma. Shuma means to evaluate exactly what the market would bring in for movable objects. And if you've ever participated in an auction for movable objects, you know that it's totally unpredictable how much you're going to bring in. You know, someone else's shmata is worth something to Ploni Almoni. You know, he really wants to just throw it out, so he puts it on eBay. And guess what? Somebody, you know, feels, I don't know, nostalgic or whatever. He thinks it's an antique, or he thinks maybe you know, he'll find some. I don't know what he thinks. You know. You know, in the old days when they used to bind books, very often they would hide things in the binding. Documents and money. So those, you know, those collectors, you know, they want to see what they break up an ancient binding, and they find sometimes you know, things of value, of historical value. So in any event, when we talk about metaltalin, it's a very shifting kind of evaluation. We don't know exactly how much it's worth, and therefore we have to appoint three experts. This is something that we're familiar with from insurance. I don't know if you ever had the experience of buying insurance or making a claim against your insurance company, and you need what's called a shamai. Did you ever hear that? I think in English it's called an assessor.
An appraiser.
Excellent. So we're talking now about appraisers, and these are professional appraisers, and they will evaluate the metaltalin so they can pay up Erchi Olai. Fine. Now the Mishnah says the following. Although three are enough, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, Echad mehem Kohen. Now this puts a whole different spin on this, because the Kohen has no more expertise than a Yisrael. But yet, when the parsha describes, we're going to get to the case of Karkos, of a person who designates his field or a piece of real estate for Hegdesh, so the Torah uses the word Kohen. So this is in Vayikra Chav Zayin, which we'll read the Shabbos. It says, Veherich HaKohen Oso. Now, technically, that pasuk is not referring to metaltolin; it's referring to karka. However, Rabbi Yehuda understands that since karka and metaltolin are written in the same parasha, then whatever it says with regard to karka, we're going to extend it to include metaltolin as well. So even in the case of metaltolin, since the Torah says in just a moment, in the next part, it says, Ve'erech HaKohen also, therefore, we're going to require a Kohen. So you can have two people who are not Kohenim, they could all be Kohenim, and one who's a Kohen. So I honestly recommend for all Kohenim that they should learn to be appraisers, because you never know when we'll need their services in Arachin. Now, what?
It's a lot for us to do between now and then.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm hoping that, you know, in the course of your study of anthropology and what are they called? What's the word for the diggings? The archaeology and so forth. You'll learn about how to evaluate things. I just heard a story recently that this woman showed up at an archaeological dig, and they didn't know what to do with her because they really had no work for her. So they sent her over to the side. They said, "Just go dig." They were laughing at her. Meanwhile, she discovered an entire chest of gold coins, like from 1,000 years ago or something like that. You never know where you'll find something. Now we get to the case of Karkos. Here, the Torah says explicitly that you require a Kohen. Okay? But not only do you require a Kohen, you require a minion. We need a panel that's made up of 10 people. One of the 10 is a Kohen, the other 9 are not. And they will be in charge of evaluating Karkos. Now the Gemara later on Daf Tes Vav, is going to ask why did the Torah up the ante when it comes to evaluating Karkos of Hegdesh, requiring as it was 10 people on the on this panel. And just again, just to get by simple pshat, we could say that karkos are very complicated. You know, real estate can really fluctuate and in a very significant way. So we need an entire panel of expert witnesses to determine the value of karka.
This is not a continuation of Rabbi Yehuda. This is back to the Sanhedrin's opinion. So it's the first opinion is with the metaltolin, two different opinions, and this one's about
Nobody argues about
nobody's
this.
Argued.
Okay. Yeah, as far as I know.
Okay.
The Adam Kayotzi Bahen. And if a person was magdish his value, Kayotzi Bahen, it also has a din of karka. Oh, this is Rabbi Yehuda, because until now we said that Harochin HaMetaltolin, we remember we quoted the Bartanura, that it was a person who said Erki Olai, he didn't have cold cash, so instead he offered Metaltolin, and for that we need a Shum of 3. Now we're saying, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that any time a person says Erki Olai, and he wants to be Magdish himself, then he could be pulled himself after an evaluation of 10 people, one of whom is a Kohen. So that is the unique shita of Rabbi Yehuda.
I think that it's Rabbi Yehuda because he doesn't say Hakarka Otisha, he says Ve'Hakarka Otisha.
The Vav also, right, excellent.
That's why, because I was confused as to whether it was a continuation of Rabbi Yehuda or separate subject.
If it wasn't a continuation, then it would be.
Right, so the requirement of a Kohen, and in the case of Karkos, when a person pulled it himself, again, the big question here, which I'm not even touching on, is how a person can be Magdish himself. Now, if he says Erki Olai, that's one thing. He says, I pledge the value of myself on the slave market. That's a certain sum of money. But if he says that he's Magdish myself, as Atzmi ani Magdish, I don't know, can you be Magdish yourself? So that's going to be a sugya later on. Now, in the old Mishnah, it's not in our Mishnah, this is the end of the Mishnah, and from now on we start a brand new Mishnah. Dine nefashos bi esrim ushlosha. And the Mishnah later on is going to derive this from a very complex Yalfusa derivation, that we need 23 judges in a capital case. Now, a classic capital case would be a murder trial, would be Eishes Ish, let's say an adultery case. The Mishnah now gives more sophisticated cases which involve not only a human being, but involve a criminal act in a partnership between a human being and an animal. Now, the human being for sure will be judged with no less than 23, because in cases like sodomy that we're going to talk about, the human being is put to death. But the Mishnah wants to tell you that even if we will not judge the person, let's say the person is unidentified, we don't have Adam to clearly identify, well, let's say the person was a shogeg, we can prove that they were forced into this situation, whatever it might be. So we're focused now on the animal. The animal has to be stoned. Okay, we're going to have a number of different cases where the animal has to be stoned. If I fast forward for a moment, we're going to have the famous case of the Shor HaNiskal, which is a case of an ox that killed a human being. And the Torah says that we have to put the ox to death by stoning. And the ox, believe it or not, you know, for those who are proponents of the rights of the animals, the animal to be put to death also requires the same minimum amount of judges that it would require in a capital case to put a human being to death, namely 23 judges. What are the other cases in which an animal is put to death? Well, we have a case of a roveah. Roveah is an animal that a male animal that actually has a relationship with a female, a Jewish girl, and the animal has to be put to death. That's called roveah. Then we have a nirva case. A nirva case is a more complicated case. Here, the animal is victimized by a male, so the animal is female, and the male is a human being, and as a result of the fact that this animal is a nirva, the Torah requires putting the animal to death. And for that we require 23 judges, b'esrim u'shlosha dayonim shenemar, because in the case of an animal, which let's talk about the case of a roveah, where a male animal has a relationship with a female human being. So it says there, this is in Parshas Kedoshim, it says, v'aragta es ha'isha v'es ha'behema, that both the woman, assuming that she willingly allowed herself to be victimized in this way, and the animal itself, both have to be put to death. And this is called a hekesh. A hekesh means when two laws are combined in one context. So here it says, v'aragta es ha'isha v'es ha'behema, and this means there's an equation here with the behema and the isha, and just like the isha herself to be judged to death under the penalty, she needs 23 judges, no less, so to the animal to be judged for being killed also requires no less than 23. Okay, so that's going to be the case of a behema harovas, where the animal is the male. Now, what about the case where a human being, a male, has a relationship with a female animal? The Omer in the Pasuk says this is the case of nirva, again in the same chapter in Vayikra. And it says there, v'ish asher yitein, I'm reading the whole pasuk, v'ish asher yitein shchovto b'behema, mos yumas, he himself who sodomized an animal will be put together. V'es ha'behema tarogu, and you will kill the animal. Once again, the Torah is setting up a hekesh between the animal and the human being to tell us that both of them require no less than 23 judges. Then we have the case of Shor HaNiskal, which is an animal. We'll see a whole list of animals. Now we're talking about a shor, but it applies to many different animals that kill a human being. And the animal is judged for stoning the esrim v'shlosha with no less than 23 judges. Shenema, because now we're learning Parashas Mishpatim, and it says, Hashor yisakel v'gam ba'olav yumas. Now again, there's a whole discussion of what gam ba'olav yumas is. The human being did not murder anyone, but apparently he was negligent in watching his belligerent ox, and as a result, the human being was killed. So, gam bi'olav yumas. He also deserves to die, but we're going to accept a kofar, and we'll have to evaluate the victim, and then we impose a compensation package on the owner of the shor. But the shor himself will be stoned. But in the same pasuk, it says Gambi all of Yumas, referring to the human being, the owner of the animal. And therefore, we're going to derive the conclusion that Kimisas Abailam Kach Misas Ashar, the same way that we can only put the Bailam to death in a case where he actually murdered someone, in the present or through the verdict of a 23 judge presiding, Kach Misas Ashar, we will not give a verdict on the shor that it should be put to death with less than 23 judges. Now the Mishnah goes on to give us a list of various killer animal. There's a word for that, isn't there? I have to get a thesaurus. Okay, a killer animal. And what are the killer animals?
Beast of the wild?
Not necessarily.
It's a very specific word in English. Either you know it or you don't know. It's not a beast. The beast is a general term, but there's a very specific word about animals that kill. Okay, if I had a thesaurus, I would look for it.
All animals kill.
Okay. Hazeev, Vehari, Vadov, Vehanamer, Vehabardalis, Vehanachosh.
Predators.
Maybe predators, okay. Predators are usually animals that kill other animals. But in any event, we start with a wolf, we go on to a lion, then we have a bear. Again, there are a whole bunch of different bears, but some bears are very dangerous, as you and I know. Vehanamer. Some say, again, it's going to be a gigantic machlok, is exactly what the difference between an amer and a bardalus is. But some say that an amer is a leopard. And then the question is, what is a bardalus? So we have a long footnote here about what is a bardalus. Okay.
We had him something there. Like bigger than a weasel that comes in.
Right. It's also Gemara Bava Kama about the bardalus. Maybe it's a hyena, maybe it's a weasel of some sort. Some say it's a skunk. I don't know that a skunk is a killer of a human being, but I guess, you know, a baby could have shown or whatever.
Yeah, my arch girl calls it a polecat.
P-O-L-E? Never heard
small,
of it.
A mountain lion animal, like a lion.
Oh, it's a lion?
A cat.
So the lion family. It's a chayah. It's in all these cases, if these animals kill the human being, they have to be judged in a court made up of 23 judges. And the Mishnah in Bava Kama says, Echad Shar vi Echad Ze'ev Ariv Adova Bardalus, a Mishnah at the end, but somewhere in the middle of Bava Kama. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer says, you know what? Don't even wait to bring the animal into court. But rather call a Kodem Lahargon Zacha. These animals are very dangerous. We're not going to start capturing the animal, bring it into Beis Din, shoot it through between the eyes, kill the animal. The animal is a dangerous animal. And the question is, what are the Chachamim going to answer to Rabbi Eliezer's argument? I mean, call it Kodem Zacha. You know, you don't want to wait around until you bring this animal into Beis Din. So on that, we're going to have a sugya later on in Masechta Sanhedrin.
I mean, these are cases where the animal doesn't belong to someone. I mean, I don't have my own little zoo and somebody...
On the contrary, I would incline to say that according to Chachamim, since the case, you know, your paradigmic case in the Torah is someone who owns an ox, you know, I don't know if you have to own a zoo. I was in Thailand and we have some beautiful pictures of me holding a baby leopard. You know, my wife refused to hold the leopard, but there are places where you can hold an alligator. You know, if you go like to southern Florida and stuff like that, you know, you go see the Indians there, they hold on to alligators. Now, I don't know why the alligator is not mentioned here. The alligator, I was told, moves faster than the speed of light, and the alligator could kill you in a second. It's a lot more dangerous in a sense than a bear. You know, sometimes you confront a bear, there are things they tell you to do, and you can, you know, the bear might you might get lucky, and the bear will go for the berries instead of for your berries. But in the case of an alligator, I mean, you're a dead man. I mean, that's it. You know, if the alligator just shoots out. So I'm not sure if people own these animals. That's a good question. The Ramban, in his commentary, believe it or not, on the beginning of the Chumash in Breishis, speaks about a shor that's ownerless, whether we have to put the shor to death or not. And he says it really depends upon whether or not we're killing the animal because the animal is an agent of man, or because the animal is a dangerous, you know, danger to society. So that's called the behemas hefker, whether or not he's chayev skila. Now, at this point, the Mishnah enters into, again, it's a new Mishnah in the old Mishnahs, enters into the question of a mass chiyuv misa. When I say a mass chiyuv misa, it's in certain situations where the Torah requires us to put a lot of people to death. The classic case is going to be what's called an Irani Dachas, where most of the city was somehow seduced by some idol worshiper to worship an idol or to some deity, and we have to judge the entire city and raise it to the ground. Or, for example, the first case in our mission in this section is Ein Donim Loes HaShevet. So we're talking about an entire Shevet in Yisrael that worships Avodah Zarah, and bemazed, it was done deliberately. Rashi here adds another thing, in chata rov hashevet. It doesn't have to be the entire shevet, it would be even most of the shevet. Okay, the other mefarshim say no, it's got to be the entire shevet. Be that as it may, we have a requirement here of 71 judges. This is the first time in the Mishnah that we go not just beyond 3, but even beyond 23. We've never had a case where you require more than 23 judges. Even in a capital crime, there was no requirement of anything more than 23. Here we're going to require the highest court in the land, otherwise known as Sanhedrin HaGdolah, in order to judge the Shevet. And then there are individuals who, if they have to be judged, because they are on a special status level, then instead of putting them into the general context of Dinei Nefashos, we're going to require, which would suffice 23, we're going to require a Sanhedrin. Let's count how many people fit into that category. Number one, we have a Navi Sheker. So we're talking about a Navi who claims to have received a prophecy which he transmits in the name of God, and we know that this is a false prophecy. And there's an entire perek here in Masechta Sanhedrin called Elu Heina Nechnokim, which dedicates itself to these various people, categories of sinners who are chayv chenek. Chenek is a very severe kind of death penalty. There are four different categories of death penalty. So a Navi Sheker is put to death with chenek. Then we have another case of a Kohen Gadol. Now, in the case of a Kohen Gadol, he may have violated any avera of a capital nature. It doesn't matter which crime it was. But if it was a capital crime, then you would think it requires no more than 23 judges. But the answer is no. Because it's a Kohen Gadol and his special status, we're going to up the ante and require a Beis Din of Sanhedrin. Now, how many judges sit on this Sanhedrin, this Beis Din HaGadol? So that's a machlokas between the Tanakhama and Rabbi Yehuda. We're going to reflect now the shita of the Tanakhama. And the Tanakhama shita is that you need 71 judges. And that's going to be derived, as we'll soon see, from the pasuk that says that Moshe gathered together 70 elders, and Moshe himself was a member of the court, and that jacks up the number to 71. Rabbi Yehuda is going to say that Moshe Rabbeinu did not himself preside over the court, but rather he gathered together 70 elders, and all you need is the number 70, you don't need 71. Now we say, Emotzien, Lemilchemes, Arishus, El Alpi, Bezdin, Shal Shivim, V'Echa. There are two categories of of a military, two types of military campaigns. One military campaign is what's called a Melchemes Mitzvah, which means either to conquer the seven nations that occupy the land, we call them Palestinians today, and they have to be destroyed, Lo Sechai Kol Neshama, and Yoshua embarked on that mitzvah, and that requires just simply a Beis Din, a regular Beis Din to decide. We go out to such a Melchama. The second category of Melchama's mitzvah would be a Molech, and the third would be an adversary, an enemy of the Jewish people that's threatening to fight a war against us. Then we have something called the Melchama's Rishus. That means to expand the boundaries of the land of Israel. And this was typically the Melchama of David HaMelech. At the time of David HaMelech, he wanted to expand up to Aram Tsova, which is today Syria. And for that, you need not just the regular Beis Din, you need the decision, the agreement of the Sanhedrin Agdol, the highest court in the land. Okay, that's called the Melchemes Rishus. Okay. Next. Ein mosifin al ha'ir v'al ha'zoris LLP Beis Din shel shivim v'yecha. We mentioned before that Yerushalayim is endowed with a certain specific unique sanctity, such that you can eat Maaser Sheni, Neter Avai, within the bounds of Yerushalayim. The Rambam adds, by the way, that anywhere in Yerushalayim you have a mitzvah, d'oraisa, of lula for 7 days, under the pasuk Usmachtem lifnei Hashem Elokeichem. That's also reflective of Kedushas Yerushalayim. And now we want to expand the bounds of Yerushalayim. So in order to do so, we have to go through an entire ritual, and that ritual has to be supervised, and also there has to be an agreement of the Beis Din HaGadol, the highest court of the land, made up of 71 judges. Now, there's a discussion here in the Achronim, I'll just mention it, it's not really for us, about something called Ayoros Mukafos Choma. And that's at the end of Sefer Vayikra. A city that is walled has a certain sanctity to it. And therefore, for example, a Tame, let's say Mitzorah, for example, it has to be exiled from such a city. Or for example, if you sell property in such a city, you have rights to redeem your property within 12 months. In any event, there's a Kedushas Ir HaMukefes Choma, and there too, if you want to expand the bounds of such a city, you likewise need the agreement of the highest court in Israel. So the question is, why is it that our Mishnah, at least the way Rashi interprets it, is referring exclusively to Yerushalayim? It's not a din in Yerushalayim, it's even a din in Ir HaMukefes Choma. So that's one issue that the poskim address, and I'll just quickly read the answer that they offer, is Shema Af Bezin Shel Shim V'Yachad Eni Yechom LaHosef Aleim. That once there's a choma, there's a wall that surrounds the city, that wall, because of its security against the enemies, generates a Kedusha, that Kedusha can never be expanded. Meaning, Kedushas Yerushalayim is not a Kedushas Chomos. Again, today they talk about the wall that surrounds Yerushalayim, but the Kedusha of Yerushalayim can be expanded beyond those walls. Again, under the supervision of the highest court of Israel. But in the case of Ir Mukefes Choma, because the Choma defines the city and its Kedusha, outside of that circumscribed area, there's no possibility of adding. Then there's another question here. What about Har HaBayis? Har HaBayis has an even higher level of Kedusha than Yerushalayim itself. How do we expand the boundaries of Har HaBayis? And here too he has a whole long discussion. Do we have the power to expand the Kedusha of Har HaBayis beyond its natural borders? The fact that the Mishnah omits that would seem to indicate that there's no possibility of expanding the Kedusha of Har HaBayis. The Mishnah continues. Ein osin ir anidachas LLP Bezdin shel shivim v'yechad. As we said earlier, if the majority of the city were seduced to violate Avodah Zarah, we completely destroy the city. That has to be a decision of a judiciary body that's made up of 71 judges. Now the Gemara goes, the Mishnah takes a digression. Is there such a word?
Yep.
A digression? The Mishnah now digresses into some of the laws of Yer Nidachas. This has nothing to do with how many judges have to sit on the court. And the Mishnah limits the judiciary powers of creating an Yer Nidachas. Number one, Ein Osin Yer Nidachas Bisfar. Okay, there were certain cities that were situated on the borderline of Eretz Yisrael, bordering in the north or in the south, and those cities are called Sfar. And a Sfar does not lend itself to becoming an Ir HaNidachas. The Ir HaNidachas has to be surrounded by the land of Israel. If it's not surrounded on all sides by the borders of Israel, it's on the boundary, such that part of the city faces outside of the land of Israel. It's not called a city that lends itself to Ir HaNidachas. Ir HaNidachas is only in Eretz Yisrael. Velo Sholosh. A Bezdin is not allowed to declare three cities as Arei Nidachas. Havel Osim Achas Oshtayim. The maximum number of cities that they could declare as an Irani Dachas is two, not three. And the Gemara is going to have a whole sugi exactly what this is talking about. Now we have the Machlokas. How many judges are necessary to make up the Sanhedrin? Sanhedrin Gedol Oysa Shel Shivim V'Yechad. According to Tanakama, a Sanhedrin requires no less than 71 elders, 71 judges. Ktana, a regular Sanhedrin, which is not the Sanhedrin Ketana, the Sanhedrin that's necessary for a capital case, that's made up of Esrim Ushlosha, 23 Dayanim. Minayin L'gdola Shehi Shivim V'Echad. What's the source in the Torah for the fact that you need 71 judges to make up a Sanhedrin? I'm talking about Sanhedrin Agdola. Shenemar, because Hashem commands Moshe, Osmoli, gather together for me Shivim Ish Miziknei Yisrael, who Moshe al Gabeir.
Moshe is with him.
Right, Moshe is in addition to the 70. He gathers together the 70, appoints them, and he himself is part of the Bezdin. And this is based on a pasuk in Baalosch. It says, "V'nasu oscha b'masa'am." Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda says shivim. He holds that Moshe Rabbeinu was not part of the Bezdin. So there are shivim zakenim to judge without Moshe Rabbeinu. Either pasuk says "V'nasu oscha b'masa'am," which seems to indicate that he's part of the Bezdin. And he has to reinterpret this pasuk. Gemara Daf Yud Zayin is going to say that according to Rabbi Yehuda, this pasuk is not referring to Moshe Rabbeinu as a dayan on the Bezdin, but rather Moshe Rabbeinu is being compared to this Kanim. That just like this Kanim who made up this Bezdin had to have a number of qualities. They had to be what's called Shleimim and not a Balmum, and they had to be Miyuchasim, as opposed to someone who came from a ger. And those were the qualifications of a Sanhedrin Agdola. Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah describes, had the same qualities. I'm sure you've all heard the famous story that when Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was taken in for surgery, he asked his son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, what the nature of the surgery was. Would he be possible for the Sanhedrin? Because if he would be a Balmum, if they would amputate a certain limb of his body, then he could no longer serve on the Sanhedrin. Moshe was hoping that they would re-establish Sanhedrin and that he would be kosher, he could sit on the Sanhedrin. I can't vouch for the truth of the story, but that's the story that I heard. Maybe you heard the same story.
His teeth that he didn't want. In one of the removed.
Oh, it was a dentistry? It wasn't a case of surgery. That makes more sense.
That's what I heard.
Uminayim l'ketana she'ishal esrim v'shlosha. How did we know that a classic bezdin for a capital crime is made up of 23 judges? Shenemar. Now this is in the Pasha Rotzeach at the end of Sefer Bamidbar. V'shaftu ha'edu mitzilai, one of the most famous psukim in the Torah. Now, the key to understand this drush is, number one, the word edo, which repeats itself twice, and number two, to understand that this edo, these two edos, so to speak, have combined together to form an entity that has a double function. Number one, shaftu, shofetes, number two, hitzilu, matzelis. So what does the word Eda indicate? And the Mishnah is going to tell us that the word Eda, which is an assembly, a congregation, is made up of no less than 10. So now we have a source for 20 judges, because it says Eda twice. What are the functions of this double Eda? Number one, Eda Shofetes, and number two, Matzelis. In other words, they will either determine that the accused is vindicated, that's called Matzelis, or condemned, that's called Shofetes. So now we're up to the number 20. Okay, and then we're going to have to add 3. We're going to see how we derive that conclusion. But first, how do you know that the word Eda means 10? Minayin le'eda she'asara, and this is a Mishnah also in the Masechta Megillah, she'nemar, because the Pasuk says, this is in the Parsha of Meraglim, how many Meraglim were there?
12.
But then it says, after the Meraglim return, Hashem says to Moshe, Ad Masai le'eda ha'ra zos. Yatzu Yoshua Kalev. So the word Eda here is only an Eda Ra, which excludes Yoshua Kalev. They came back with good tidings about the land. And therefore the word Eda means 10. The Mishnah in Megillah derives from the same drasha, Ein Darasha Begedusha Pachos Me'asara, that anything that requires a tzibur of Klal Yisrael, that tzibur is represented by 10 people. Eda is the same as a tzibur, and the magic number is 10. Uminayin lahavi shlosha, why do you add od shlosha, another 3, to jack it up to 23? So now at this point, we would suggest that you have to jack it up to 21. For sure. Forget about 23. Why 21? Excellent. We need a majority rule. That's, we can't have a Bezdin that lends itself. It's called a Bezdin Shokul. It has, you know, if you split up the Matzelis and the Shofetis, you'll end up with a stalemate. So you definitely need one more to get 11 against 10.
Then how can you have a Shita that you can have a Sanhedrin of 70? 70 can also be 35.
That's because the Sanhedrin HaGdola, okay, this we discussed yesterday. I'll try to give it to you in a, you know what, let's hold off on it. I just want to, my goal is to, in the next 5 minutes, finish the Mishnah.
Okay.
So in any event, Mimashma Shenemar, right, when the Torah commands us to appoint a Bezdin that would oversee a capital case dealing with Fashos, so it says in Parashat Shoftim, Lo Siya Achre Rabim Leros. In other words, we're not going to rely on a rove. Interesting. So we're talking about, let's say, 21 judges. And in the case of 21 judges, let's say 11 elect to put this accused to death. That's called leros. And 10 vindicate. So in such a case, you have majority leros, but the Torah tells you lo siya achre rabim leros. We're not going to rely on a majority, in this case, a majority of one, to put this nidon to death. Shomea ani, should I assume, based on this, she'eye imahem letova, that maybe if the majority will elect to vindicate the criminal, then we could rely on a rove. In Cain, loma nemar achre rabim lahatos. In other words, the Torah on the one hand seems to assume that we can rely on a rove, and at the same time the Torah tells you, lo si achrei rabim leros. So how do we reconcile this seeming contradiction? And the Mishnah says, "Lo kehatayoscha l'tova, hatayoscha l'ra'a, hatayoscha l'tova al pi echad, hatayoscha l'ra'a al pi shnayim." When the Torah says, "Achrei rabim lahatos," it's coming to teach me that don't think that a majority of one is insufficient. It's insufficient l'ra'os, meaning to condemn the accused, but it is sufficient l'hatos. L'hatos means to vindicate the accused. And for that, all we need is a majority of one. So theoretically, if we have 11 judges on the court to vindicate and 10 judges to condemn, that should be perfect, because that should come under the halacha of Achrei Rabim Lahatos. However, we're going to require a Beis Din that has the capacity for both Lahatos, meaning Latova, to vindicate, and Liros, which means to find the Nidon guilty. And therefore he says, Al Pi Echad, you know, it's just like the Torah says that you cannot rely on one to tip the scale in favor of the condemners, if I can call them that, is you need al pi shnayim, you're going to need a majority of two. Now, if you're going to have a majority of two, then you're going to require a Beis Din of 22 members, because then you could have 12 against 10 to condemn the nidah. But the Mishnah goes on and says, v'ein Beis Din shakul, but you cannot have a Beis Din of 22 because we require an odd number on the court and not an even court. So again, on the one hand, in order to make sure that this Beis Din could be both Matzeles and Shofetes, Shofetes means to condemn, and we need a majority of two in order to condemn the needle, so we're going to have to jack it up to 22, but 22 is an even number, and that's called a Beis Din Shakul. We have a principle called Ein Beis Din Shakul. So in order to accomplish both goals, namely to decide that we have a majority of two to condemn the accused, and at the same time it shouldn't be an even number of members of the court, we jack it up to 23. Now, in the final analysis, how many judges would it take to vindicate the accused? All we need is a majority of one. However, in order to condemn the person, we're going to need a majority of two. So that's how we reconcile the psukim.
That also applies to the 71.
Well, that was the question the doctor asked before. What about the Beis Din HaGadol? You know, how do we divvy it up into an odd number and so forth and so on? The Kama Yehe Be'ir Utehe Re'uyo LeSanhedrin. What is the size? Now, again, we said that there's something called the Sanhedrin HaGadola. It was only one high Supreme Court for all of Israel. But then there's something called the Sanhedrin HaKtana. Sanhedrin HaKtana is for smaller cities, and all we need is to appoint 23 judges. Well, how small is small? Meaning, what's the minimum population of a city in order to be in the parsha of an ear of a city that requires the appointing of a Sanhedrin? Again, we're talking about the Sanhedrin of a 23 court. So here we have machlok shim Tanakam and Rav Nechemya. The Tanakam says we need mea v'esrim. If there are 120 inhabitants in the city, it's called a city. Like you have a kibbutz, let's say, or a moshav, and there are 120 members of the moshav, that would be enough to constitute a city and obligate the appointment of a Sanhedrin Ketana. How do we arrive at the number 120? That's going to be the sugya on Daf Yud Zayin, and 120 is symbolic of a certain secret number. Rav Nechemya Omer, no, that's too small of a city. That's a little hamlet, a little town. It's a village. It's not enough to be called an ear, and we will not appoint the Sanhedrin for such a small city, but rather we need Masayim U'Shloshim. Now, how does he derive Masayim U'Shloshim, 230? And that he explains himself. Keneged Sore Asoros. Right? In Parshas Yisro, and this was the great suggestion, the recommendation of Yisro, we appoint sarim over asaros. So in other words, each one of the dayanim that's appointed on this bezdin should be ruling, so to speak, over at least 10 members of the city. And in this case, how many judges would it take to get to the number 23? Right? We've already derived from the psukim, Eda, that you need 23 judges, and if each one of these judges has to preside over 10, so it's going to be 10 times 23 is 230. That's the shita of Rabbi Nachman.
Are they picked from the town? Sanhedrin? If so, you need 230 plus 10, plus 23. Otherwise, they're only residing Otherwise, they're only residing.
They're not included in the number of 10 because they have to preside over 10.
Yeah, right.
So you're going to need the local people, that's 230, and then you can appoint the dayanim. You know where the dayanim are living, or where their where their domicile is second. Okay, now before I let you go, here's the suggestion I wanted to throw out. If anyone is interested, the way I've worked it in my schedule, I did not leave enough time. I'll explain to you why. For Sanhedrin Be'iun. Now, those who've been with me in the past know that I like to pick up this year on a more in-depth level. So I like to give time for that. But what I did was, for the 11:45, which is my Iyun slot, I've chosen Masechta Ksubis. That's the third parak of Ksubis. The Bekiyas part of that, the limud, is going to be in the Shtiblach, so I don't expect you to be there. That's at 7:30 in the morning. But I didn't, so I have now for Ksubis, I have a limud, which I call Gmarashi and Selected Tosis, and I have the Iyun, which is 11:45, that's for Ksubis Perek Shlishi, the third Perek of Ksubis. For Sanhedrin, I was interested in coming up with a couple of slots, maybe two times a week, three times a week, or whatever, for Iyun. So that what we do here, we can take on a more profound level. So if you're interested, what I can do is I have a whole part of my morning which is free. Again, I'm just throwing it out there. If anyone's interested, let me know. And then we can get together, let's say, we take a break, get together at about 9:45 or 10, maybe twice a week, and we can learn Sanhedrin Be'iun. I also offer an Ian Shin Sanhedrin on Wednesday nights at 8:30 right here in this room. Okay then? Everyone should have a great day and be matzlo. Okay then?